Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Womenhood and International Relations podcast. I'm your host, Natalia Bonilla. And for today's episode, we will be reviewing The Queenmaker. This is season 6 of the podcast, and I'm so excited to launch with an episode that perhaps some of you will be like, Natalia, why are you reviewing this series? It is corporate and political drama, but it is so essential to understand the roadmap that women in politics experience. And if you are following different presidential elections, if you're working to get your candidate, your female candidate elected, or if you're working in a policy making regarding the access and the representation and the quality of more female candidates in political elections, then you're definitely going to like this series. It is currently Netflix. I don't know where else you can find it, but it is worth watching. And for my friends and colleagues in Mexico, if you're currently following the presidential elections of 2024, the campaign trail of Claudia Sheinbaum and Xochitl Galvez, which are the two female front runners of the 2024 elections, presidential elections, about to take place this June 2024, don't wait much longer to watch it, because a lot of pieces in the chessboard will fall into place once you start seeing this campaign trail of the Queenmaker. And I did consider recording this episode showcasing the parallels of situations between the Queenmaker TV series and the current campaign trails of Galvez and Sheinbaum, and some scenarios that may, you know, shed light into what being a woman in politics actually means. But then I remembered that I don't know who's gonna listen to this podcast and to this episode. And since there is a lot of animosity in different parts of the world around freedom of expression, I don't know who's gonna listen to this. I understand that when there are presidential elections, the partisanship is very strong, and sometimes colors or ideologies triumph more over the ideas that are going to be shared. So I decided to just review the TV series, showcase some political commentary and connect it to the work that we do here in the podcast on feminist theory applied to IR. And if you're in Mexico, or if you are working on this topic or this field of women in politics, and if you're very interested in, you know, engaging in a safe conversation on this type of dynamics, not only in Mexico, but in other parts of the world, then please be sure to reach out. You can DM us on Instagram or LinkedIn. We are currently at womenhood_IR. You can find us very easily there. I would love to hear your thoughts, your feedback, and if anything that I share here, or if you watch the series and something resonated with you, please do not hesitate to reach out, and we'd love to engage in a interesting discussion together, and seek ways that we can surpass some of these challenges or support women, not only those that are participating in the ballots, but those that are work in the campaign trail, that are behind the scenes, that are doing the strategy or working communications, or even the female voters. Like, that's something so interesting that I'm excited to share here, because this TV series addresses all of these areas. So that's why I am launching this season 6 with this review. So let me just make the simple disclaimer that I always do whenever I do a TV series or a movie review. I'm gonna be sharing a lot of spoilers. So if you do not like spoilers, if you prefer to watch it first, then this is your cue. You know, this is your cue to pause this episode and come back at a later time. Don't worry, this episode hopefully will stay on the platform and you can listen to it when you feel good. I'm gonna be listing down below some recommended articles on the topics that I'm gonna share here. So even if you don't want to listen to the full episode but want to explore the different dynamics that we are gonna discuss here, then those links are already in the description box of this episode. So I'm gonna leave a simple pause for you to click if you don't like spoilers. For those of you that stayed, thank you. Let's go. Okay, so I'm gonna do like a rundown of the episodes, because unlike other shows and series that we have reviewed so far in this podcast, this one actually has like a gradual progression and we can see the character development and the reasons behind why women participate in politics and the ways in which they join campaigns. So I'm gonna start with episode one, where we have the introduction to Juan Dohee, one of the main characters of this series. She is the general manager for a strategic planning team at the Eunsong Group, which is one of the largest companies in South Korea, mainly in the retail sector, the shopping centers type of conglomerate. And Juan Dohee in the first episode is presented as the right hand of the president of the company. So she holds a lot of power. She also works as the PR, in a way, the PR and crisis manager for the company. And she has a team of people. One of them, of the team members, is Han Is-seul, who is apparently involved in an infidelity situation. She is portrayed as the lover in the first episode, as the lover of Baek Jamin, who is the son-in-law of the president of the Eunsong Group, Song Yong-sim. So Baek is married to the daughter of Song Yong-sim, the president, and he's apparently in this loved relationship with Han. That's something that we get in the first episode. There's a squirrel, a lover squirrel, like Han wants to say that they are together, and apparently she jumps out of the building and dies. And Juan Dohee was about to... previous that this happened, she was laying off Han and basically shaming her for, you know, being the mistress or the lover of Baek Jamin. And Han was saying that she was not the mistress of Baek, that she was raped or, you know, like violently attacked by Baek. And Juan Dohee, once again, the PR, didn't believe her. So when she looks at the body of Han after she apparently in the first episode committed suicide, she carries a lot of guilt. And that becomes the primary reason that Juan Dohee takes in order to make sense for her next steps. Because the more that she addresses the case of Han, the more resistance that she receives from Son, which is the Eunsong Group president. She's been working with the company for over 10 years, over more than a decade, and she expected the president to be more empathetic or less focused on the risk management or, you know, like trying to save face of the company. And there is a big scene in the second episode where Son and Juan Dohee have a conversation in like a hunting trip. And Son, who has this hunting gear, she even has some dogs to collect the prey that, you know, she takes or kills with the rifle. She's basically dismissing Juan Dohee's concerns over Baek and Baek's relationship with Han. So at one point, it is reminded and it is contextualized the topic of class and the loyalty and respect that people from lower classes need to have to people that are considered rich or that are the owners of companies, etc. And it is very singular trait that we can find in whenever we are researching the case of South Korea, but also we can find other similar caste systems or informal caste systems in other parts of the world, not only in India, but also in Mexico and in Paraguay and Argentina. You know, like, how do people from different classes relate to one another? And we have covered in a previous episode, like a review of the Squid Games, and what motivates people to join these type of bizarre games in order to pay off their debts or in order to scale up or rise up the ladder. I don't know the correct word, but to go up the ladder of economics. And I think the movie Parasite, also based in South Korea, showcases this. But yeah, the interesting thing about these two episodes is the contextualization of class and how people relate to one another based on this socio-economical status. And what are the agreed promises or the agreed loyalties that people consciously or unconsciously undertake as long as to stay in the good graces of those that we consider to be above us or above others, etc. And in the first episode, we see that Hwang Do-hee is very, very loyal, and she is not afraid to be ruthless and to be very unemotional. And in a way, there's this quote that says that she could be seen as a mad dog because the only thing that she knows is how to bite. This is according to the first episode. But then in the second episode, in this hunting scene, I'm going back to again to my point. In the hunting scene of the second episode, Hwang Do-hee is resistant to follow Song's instructions. And then Song tells her to stop looking or researching or investigating Baek's mistress relationship. Like, she should not worry about Baek. Like, Baek is going to be presented and projected to be the next mayor of Seoul, the capital city of South Korea. And because she wanted her son-in-law to become a politician in order to gain permission to construct one of the biggest shopping malls or shopping centers in an area or a populated area where a lot of people will lose their homes, a lot of people will lose their jobs, she needs to have her son-in-law as mayor of Seoul so she could have that permit, and she doesn't care about the lives that are going to be impacted by this decision. So in this hunting year, Hwang Do-hee says very clearly no. She is going to refuse to follow orders. And this is after a brilliant shot of a dog that after Sun killed a bird, the dog, the hunting dog, goes and fetch the bird and brings it over. And she felt, you know, the shot of the dog and the shot of Juan, you know, like the video shot, is showcased as, wow, like, she looks at me like I'm her mutt. And this is something that before, those that are in the family of Sun believe that Hwang Do-hee is the mutt or the dog of Sun. And for those of you that may be like, what's mutt? I also look for the translation on Google because it didn't say dog in the English subtitles. It just said like mutt, and I started looking for it, and it says perrito faldero. So it's like a dog that always follow you around. So it's the analogy of seeing herself as the one that follows orders, and then she releases her scarf as a synonym of taking off her leash. And at that moment, there is a breaking free of Hwang Jo-hee of, okay, so now I'm gonna be my own independent self. I'm gonna bring down the Eunsoung group because I don't agree with Baek's running for power. And even if this means that I'm gonna have all the family that has a lot of power, a lot of connections, a lot of money against me, then so be it. It is very apparent in the conversations that these rich people have how they view others of other classes or lower classes as disposable. So, okay, so this dog didn't want to follow orders, then I can find another one that will be glad to follow it, you know? So there's this question of, okay, so you have over 10 years a lady working with you, and then she refuses to sweep to follow your orders, and then suddenly you're gonna take it on with her but not with your son-in-law for being an infidel to are you infidel a cheater I think the word is the cheater a cheater with your daughter. Like, he's cheating on your daughter, but you're not angry at Baek because a man can do whatever they want. Or because it's interesting, like, how in this TV series they frame rich people as this, in this mindset that they can stand others as long as they are useful to them. When you stop being useful to me and my interests and my goals, etc., then goodbye, ciao, see you next life. So it is interesting that the concept of value of life, and you're only valuable if you're useful to their means. When you stop following orders, when you stop being useful to them, they just discard you. So that is one of the biggest scenes that I think frames the context of class in South Korea and what drives people perhaps into politics. Because Hwang Jo-hee then felt that she needed to back another candidate that could avoid Baek to become an elected official. So she started reconnecting this lawyer, human rights lawyer, that used to do like a strike on the terrace or the top floor of the building, and she made like a whole camp there, you know, advocating for labor rights of the employees of the Eunsoung group. And this human rights lawyer, she's Oh Kyung-suk. Oh Kyung-suk, which she is considered the rhino, that's her nickname. She's considered the rhino because she basically is very stubborn and very strong in her values, and she will go ahead and, you know, in an stampede if necessary to achieve her goals. So Oh Kyung-suk was never interested in, you know, engaging in becoming the mayor of Seoul. But Hwang Jo-hee wanted to reconnect with Oh Kyung-suk because Oh Kyung-suk had a lot of anger towards Eunsoung group. And at one point, the Eunsoung group's police or the security, you know, the security team, at one point wanted to kill Oh Kyung-suk and to take her off her the strike and portray it as an accident. And Hwang Jo-hee prevented it. So in a way, Oh Kyung-suk owed Hwang Jo-hee her life. But Hwang Jo-hee started buttering the cup of Oh Kyung-suk and saying, your community is on the front line to being completely destroyed by this shopping mall idea that the Eunsoon group wants to create. And if Baek Jae-min becomes the mayor of Seoul, then your house, your friend's house, everything is gonna go. And I find these scenes of resistance between Oh Kyung-suk and Hwang Jo-hee extremely, extremely important. If anything, take these scenes with you, because there is two parts of this scene, one that we see it in the third episode and the fourth episode, and one that we see it in the elections debate. I'm gonna go episode three. So we are learning about how greed will turn a person into a snake. That's something that they are talking about in these rich circles, and how it is important to buy party members and get them whatever they need in order to gain popular vote. If that means that they need to, that companies or private companies need to pay for libraries in each neighborhood so they accept a candidate, if that means to they need to pull tricks to embarrass the other candidates or the other mayor. It also portrays this topic of how the rich people or those that have economic power tend to recycle people and repeat their methods. And whoever rejects an order is seen as a betrayal or is seen as a traitor. And because traitors cannot exist because they are a menace or a threat, they need to be destroyed. This is the paradigm from which Song's family operate. But the paradigm that Hwang Jo-hee, as the student or the right hand of these people, was attack your opponent's weaknesses and make them destroy themselves. So it's interesting because I wonder if class has to do with this type of lesson incorporation, you know, because if the rich operate in a way that they want to destroy those that are considered a menace or a threat, what happens to people that come from poorer classes or from middle class, etc.? Why is it that they don't want to engage in destroying the other, but rather prefer to see them destroy themselves? Is it part of the class that make them think, if I destroy whoever I consider to be a threat, I don't have the economic means to avoid jail time. But if I am a rich person, then it's easy, you know, to just destroy them or to do anything necessary because I have money and I will never go to jail. Like, you know, like it's very interesting how that rationale is connected as well to class and to the resources that we may have in hand, the networking connections, or maybe if you're a rich people, you can buy off a judge, or you can, you know, ask for a favor for a political candidate or political person to grant you a pardon, you know, like it's very interesting. There's the scene where Hwang Jo-hee and Oh Kyung-suk are talking to one another. Oh is basically feeling pressured and coerced to join the political race. And it's so interesting. It's like running in politics, not for the sake of Seoul's future, but just so the other candidate, Baek, which is considered the worst, according to Hwang Do-hee. And also, Oh doesn't like Baek, but, you know, like, the reason cannot be, I don't want the other to win. Therefore, that's my main motive to run. So, if you're connecting the dots, I don't need to explain them so explicitly, but you can start seeing some trends in your own country or in countries where you are seeing female political candidates running against each other, or candidates regardless of their sex and gender running against each other, not necessarily looking out for the goodness of the people or because they have a vision or because they have a dream, but rather they are pushed into the political race so other people that are considered to be worse than them do not win. Okay, I'm gonna leave it there. I'm not gonna go too deep into the ocean. But just keep in mind that this is the possibility. And perhaps it may explain why some political campaigns are facades, smokes and mirrors. They don't offer anything at the end of the day. Like, there are some political campaigns and some political candidates that are just there to fill a void. They don't have something meaningful or consequential to say. And I wonder why, you know? Like, that's one of the things that this episode provides. So the strategy here is beating the primaries, the queen and the star of the Reform Party. The other female candidate is presented, which is Seo Min-jung. And Seo Min-jung is already an established and veteran political candidate. And Seo, she dresses very good. She never speaks ill. She's always, you know, picture perfect, ready for media, etc. And when Oh enters as female political candidate in the race, she is portrayed as a competition to Seo. Why go against a woman? This is explained in this episode, so please watch it. This is very good. If Seo beats the other women, Oh, in competition, then this is an easy win. That being said, that if Seo loses, being, you know, like the veteran candidate that has already served 3 terms, if she loses to a new woman, it is sending a message to the political party base of Seo that Oh is better. And it's interesting here, the concept of age as well, because Seo is older than Oh. So not only are we talking about image and, you know, like fashion and makeup and all of that, but also in terms of age and how people may look at, you know, older women. And if a younger version comes and wins over the veteran women, then does that mean that she's better? You know, like, it's very interesting, this question. So the campaign advisor of Seo said that it might not be a good idea in the debate to go after the appearance or the image or the class of Oh, because Oh represents the working class and, you know, Seo represents the establishment. So if Seo tends to smear or focuses on the image of Oh in order to affect her or create like a problem or attack her through that specific appearance, then she is shooting herself on the foot, because then people are not gonna vote for her. So it's so cool, this part, because it's how the psychology of voters work, you know? Like, this is marvelous to see it like on screen. Like, you know, when you become a political candidate, you assumed a social identity, and you're not only fighting for your causes, you're also becoming a poster child for people that look like you or people that, you know, have a similar background to you or have similar race or a similar gender identity or sexuality or etc. You know, like it's very interesting that whoever goes into politics, they are not representing themselves only and their own dreams. You know, like the social identity is not about who you are, but also who you represent and what you represent. And the mass voters tend to empathize with those who work, those that are seen as similar to them. That's why, you know, like we have these politics 101, these photos of presidential candidates rolling up their sleeves and eating sandwiches at a local bakery and going to like very empty field and shaking hands with those that work with machinery or with chickens or with agriculture, etc. Like, you know, why? Are they really doing it because they're interested in the well-being of these populations? Or are they doing it because it's part of how they will get a vote? And then once they arrive into office, they completely forget about the people that they shook hands with or made promises with or talked about their kids with. You know, like, it's so, so interesting. So yeah, at the end of this episode, I'm reaching the end, don't worry. At the end of this episode 4, there comes a question where Juan Dohi work, you know, trying to get O elected, cannot be achieved by vengeance alone. And there are three things that she said that are essential to win in politics: money, manpower, and star quality. You need the three in order to, you know, become a winner. So how much of these Korean political TV shows may be simplifying, but in an accurate way, what's needed in order to win elections? So episode 5, we have this new strategy, political strategy that is joining Baek's campaign and proposes to boycott the TV event as he'll be sidelined to a supporting role in the debate. And, you know, I found that very macho culture. Let the two women fight against each other, and whoever wins, then you fight that woman. Don't you lower yourself to this type of debate. You know, allow these two women to fight each other, and the winner, then that's the one that you take afterwards for a battle or something like that. What is this? So this new political strategies is Carl Jung. He is portrayed as this gift that the chairwoman's son gives to Baek. Carl has over 12 elections under his belt. Like, he has won 4 people and made 2 candidates president of South Korea. So he's seen as, oh my God, he's the man, you know, like he's the one that we should follow, etc. It's so interesting, the questions that Carl bring to Baek, because Carl instinctively knows that Baek doesn't have what it takes to become not only the mayor of Seoul, but the president of South Korea. So he starts asking questions about, who are you, Baek, without Aeon Song, without the group? You know, like, who were you before? Because you are not a rich person, you come from middle class, or, you know, you have a very traumatizing past, and why is it that you want to stay in this family? What do you gain in this family? So Carl says that victory is only guaranteed as long as they, you know, like the political candidates do what he says, because he's the one that knows, etc. So one of the things that is explained in this episode is that the viewers at home will remember how ugly the candidates were while ranting, they don't necessarily remember the sincerity or what was said, but rather how they looked. And I found that very funny because we are living in a meme era where, you know, like we look at debates and entertainment shows or awards, and if someone is looking at in a weird way or a funny way, then that is immediately, you know, viral on the internet, and it becomes, you know, like this huge spectacle, and then that's what people remember. So in a way, Carl and, you know, Wang Dohe and all these political strategies remind us as viewers of this TV show that the debates are not about the ideas, but rather the strength in the debates or the political debates are presented on TV are mostly 80% nonverbal communication. So that's the biggest thing that one candidate needs to focus on, is remembering to look emotional enough to be relatable while reserved enough and rational enough to make sense or to surpass the other with intelligence, etc. You know, like, it's so interesting, these things. Move forward, the debate itself was very, very good to explore how all won over sale, mostly focusing on Seo's personal life, and this young guy that she was seeing, you know, it's so interesting. You cannot win over the other based on ideas alone. That couldn't be possible. So let's try to find someone you slept with, or someone that you're interested in, or your kids, or something like that of your family, and what you do in closed doors in order to shame you on national television and, you know, like, win over, you know, like, so I found that very cliche, but and at the same time, that's what happens in political debates as well. Not in every country, but mainly what I've seen in Latin America, that is, you know, the order of the day, what's expected. So anyway, episodes 6 to 8, if anything, is more interesting to see the extent that private companies and private donors, the extent of control that private companies and private donors have on political candidates. And if you, as a political candidate, in order to win votes, say something or threaten to do something that may go against the interests of those that gave you money, how easily it is for them to just withdraw, like, say, like, okay, no more, figure it out on your own, you're left without my support. You know, like, very dramatic. But guess what? That's part of life. That's in real life. This is not only like on TV series. How fickle, if that's the word, fickle it is to support financially political campaigns, and how, I don't know if it can be quantified. Can it be quantified, the interest or the promises that political candidates want to do? Like, how much is it to fulfill the wishes of their donors versus, or their PACs, like in the United States that they have like these mega PACs, how much it is to fulfill those promises rather than to cater to the people, the actual voters? Is it a ratio of 50 to 50, or 40 to 60, or 80 to 20, or 90%, you know, fulfilling the wishes of whoever paid my campaign, and 10% actual people that voted for you, believing that you will be the change? There are so many examples to address here. But okay, can we change that? And should we change that? This is a better question. Should we change that dynamic of the financials in political campaigns? And this is something very intriguing, you know, right now that there are so many conversations about the fragility of democracies and the democratic process, because, you know, the rise of the far right or restrictive systems of governance and dictatorial types of governance, etc., in different parts of the world. But there's a question about democracy itself. Can democracy sustain itself through the donations of voters? Through the small donations of voters? Because not all voters have $10 million to pay for a political campaign. But then we get angry if a political candidate receives $100 million or $10 million of donations from big companies or private investors, etc., when we are, as voters, unwilling to give a dime to these political campaigns. And this is a serious question, you know? Like, I also have wondered this. I have not ever given $1 to any of the political candidates in Puerto Rico where I'm supposed to vote. I have not given $1. It's not because I don't believe in their campaigns. It's just because my perception is I'm gonna vote for whoever I wanna vote. I don't have the money to sustain this campaign. And I don't think that $1 is going to make a difference in the lives of these political candidates. The point here is, can we be mad at political candidates for receiving money from big investors and big companies when we as voters are unwilling or do not have the resources, which is also a topic? You know, we may not have the resources to pay for these big campaigns of whoever it is, the candidate that we are supporting. And then should we as voters get mad if the political candidate that we chose received whatever amount of millions of dollars of money to run their campaign? And do we get mad because they are privileging or prioritizing the interests of those that actually help them win? And I know that this is a loaded question and it depends on the country and the context, because, you know, there are candidates that no matter how much money they have, no matter how many donations they receive, they don't ever win the primaries or win the elections at all. So that's also a possibility, you know, like no matter how much money they have for publicity and how much promises they make, there are some candidates that money doesn't make a difference. People do not vote for them. But what about the ones that do win? You know, I'm going back to episode 1 and then episode 2. People are valuable only if they are useful to the means of the rich people. And how the rich people do see people, how the rich see people of lower classes as disposable. Do we as voters see political candidates as disposable too? Because we didn't invest in them? Or because it is the same if I vote for this one or for the other one because they're all the same? You know, like that's also a paradigm. Mainly we can see it in some countries in Latin America. You know, like it's like, da igual, todos son iguales. O sea, como que lo mismo este que el otro. O sea, como que también eso existe. O sea, pero es interesante. Like, of course, we're talking about South Korea for this TV series plotline, but I wonder if there are some parallels. We don't need to be rich to have this type of mindset towards people that run into politics. We as voters, do we see political candidates as disposable too? I mean, it depends. There are countries like Venezuela, for example, or Brazil, countries that do have a cult-like mentality of leaders. And there is an observation that can be made in the sense that people vote for whoever they feel represents them the most, or whichever personality they feel more trusting of, not necessarily what they say or how they will deal with the future of the country itself, etc. You know, like, it surpasses political partisanship. It surpasses ideology and religion, you know, and this is also a phenomenon that we can see right now in the U.S. Primaries. And maybe this is a topic for another day. I don't want to keep this episode long. So last episode, there is a conversation and a problem and a struggle that O experiences since the moment that she begins the political race. Not only does she have to change who she is and how she portrays herself, coerced in a way to fulfill these particular expectations of what the political candidates need to do in order to win an election, but also she becomes more and more alienated on the issues and the problems and the concerns that her family has, mainly her son. She has a son, a teenager, that gets into some sort of fights because there are a lot of rumors and scandals over O's sexuality, and there are some Photoshop images of O in very suggestive attire and something like that, and you know, some teenagers tend to laugh at it, and the son wants to fight for his mom's dignity, etc. And you know, it's very interesting. At one point, the fight that O has with her son in the juvenile jail, I think. Juvenile, because I don't know, maybe it's like a police station. He's behind bars. I don't know if it's a juvenile jail or something, but he's behind bars and they are fighting one another, you know, and the kid is fighting with his mom. He's telling her that she has, in a way, detached or left him alone. He felt very angry at her, at his mom. Like, you left because of this political campaign. And then she tends to consider at that point, due to the fight that she has with his son, with her son, she starts to consider to drop out of the political race because it has gone too far. Like, she sees at that moment the cracks that the political race has caused to her family and the sacrifices that she made. Would it be worthy to be the mayor of Seoul or the president of South Korea if the day after the election, the day after you win and you receive the praise of so many people, so many millions of people, you go back home and your son doesn't want to talk to you and your husband wants to divorce you? You know, like, it's very interesting. The toll and the sacrifices that women in politics particularly face. And this is not something new. I'm not like discovering, you know, like, I'm not discovering light under, you know, like, this is part of what we have seen in the history of women in politics, at least in the 20th and 21st century. It is unequal. The standards and the expectations and the challenges that women face when they enter in political races or where they want to achieve political power. at one point in this TV series, Baek is praised not only because he's like a hunk, you know, like a very handsome political candidate, but also because he utilizes the empathy to manipulate people and to portray himself as the doting father and traditional husband and wife. So he's taking this role to his advantage of the caretaker, even if he's not that. So he uses that as his part of his social identity and his charm, you know? So yeah, anyway, the thing is, are we aware of the spiritual, the physical, the mental, and the emotional toll that running an election entails, not only for the political candidate, but for the voters themselves or ourselves? Do we know how much the political elections and the prior can affect our psyche and the way that we relate to one another and the way that we relate to the system? You know, it is something that it is worth knowing. Like here, when we are approaching the end of the TV series, we see the level of disassociation and detachment that O experienced. Like 2 or 3 days prior to the election, she was considering dropping out because not only does she felt ashamed of what happened to her son, but she felt like it wasn't worth it. She had lost everything, and for what? It reminded me a bit of a movie. I think it's called Diana. It's with Naomi Watts. And she said, what does, in the movie, I don't know if she said this in real life, but in the movie, she reflected upon, what good is it to have the love of the entire world and to be adored by so many millions of people in my country and abroad if the one person that I love and the one person that I want to love me doesn't love me, doesn't want to pick me, etc. You know, like it's that type of lonely feeling that you can relate to. And it made me wonder about this candidate O and her own willingness to fight. What good does it bring to her? Power, political power, sitting down a chair, if you do not like who you have become and how others view you and how many people hate you. Because in the case of O, she lost even the support of her community members. Like many people that were neighbors of her and that she used to go to their kiosk to eat and, you know, to laugh with, etc. Like they were very angry at her because her political campaign represented things that they didn't agree with. And she lost friendships, she lost relationships and, you know, the support of her own community. I mean, it's great to, you know, have the support of other states and other provinces and other types of populations, but what if you cannot go back to where you come from or the people that once were there for you and, you know, that saw you grow and, you know, raise your children or raise your family, you know, like, is winning an election, a political seat, worth it if you don't have nowhere else to go? And this is a very loaded question because I wondered how many of these lawmakers that have been, you know, in the Senate or in the parliamentary of different countries, I'm gonna name, you know, the United States and Puerto Rico because I know more about this landscape, but that have been in that seat and running elections for over 2 or 3 decades because they made it their social identity. Like, who are they without this type of job? And then we are angry at them because they stay forever sitting on that chair. And I wonder, you know, watching this series, is it possible that they stay in this chair and then they go to these elections and become ruthless at one point in order to continue staying in this place because they don't have nowhere else to go? What if they don't have another identity that they can go back to? What if being a lawmaker became their job and who they were? And they don't know anything different, and they may not want anything different, because that will mean a crisis of identity will pursue or will entail. And you know, like this type of self-discovery process will start looming and affecting their self-esteem or their well-being. You know, the more that you start looking at the reasons why people choose to enter politics and choose to stay in politics and the extent that they are willing to uphold or withstand or endure, if that's the word, in order to not shake what they have accomplished, the more you are understanding of how transformative is the process of politics, the science of governing people, of responding to people and their needs and their interests, and their insecurities as well. I truly was surprised by that scene when O said, "This is not worth it." And she just wanted to reject, you know, going to the ballot the next day or, you know, the following days. She just wanted to withdraw from the race. It was a very brave move, because in a way she does represent the Korean people, including her husband and her son. And if her husband and her son were angry at her because she was not addressing their needs, she was not seeing them, she was not talking to them, because she was so invested into the external world, into getting the votes, into meeting random people that she may never see once again. You know, like, we are taught that politics is a science of governance, of social order, of something outside of us. But through feminist theory in IR, through our different workshops, leadership trainings, and through the work that we do here in this podcast, and the work that many of you are doing, regardless of whether you listen to this podcast or have met me at some point or not, many of you are already working on your own in many of these political science and IR fields in your own way. And we don't have to agree on the ways or the shapes or the forms or the value system, etc. But something that we learn through this process of surpassing the detachment or the externalizing of politics or seeing as something so outside of us, something we are learning is how the person, the self, the individual, the human can be political. How consciously or unconsciously people become subjects when there is a subjectivity that has the potential, if we assume it, if we reclaim it, if we want it to, because that's also a choice, there's the potentiality of the subjectivity being political, of the subjects being political, and anything we do, each step that we take being a political decision. So, in the end of this TV series, we see that O wins. We see her reconciling with her son and her family. We see her very happy. We see, you know, the vengeance of Hwang Do-hee towards Sun, the Eunsung group chairwoman. We see Baek's scandal finally shedding or coming to light, which is that Han didn't commit suicide. Rather, Baek was the one that pushed her out of the building. And we see like a very interesting resolution to the different conflicts that we saw. We saw as well, like within the family of Sun, the chairwoman of Eunsung group, we see within that family the fracture between the sisters and, you know, like how some of them wanted to continue the business in another way, what others did to get O elected, you know, and now she needs to fulfill those promises to the donors that got her elected. And probably the cycle will repeat itself again the next 4 or 6 years, depending on when the elections are called for. So did vengeance triumph over rationality? Was vengeance enough fuel to move forward this type of political campaigns? The vengeance of Hwang Do-hee, the vengeance of Oh, because she was also attacked and her son was attacked during this political campaign. The vengeance of the labor workers and those that volunteered for Oh's campaign in order to get elected. Was vengeance enough to win an election? Was strategy needed? Was a regulation of emotions needed in order to not spiral all the things out of control, or in order to give in into the lower quote-unquote tactics that could get, you know, like could harm other political candidates and, you know, help another candidate go up the polls, you know, like it's very interesting. I'm not sure that vengeance was enough. It was one of the main drivers. But I also see O did have good ideas prior to becoming a political candidate. She just didn't want the political seat. And that for me stuck, you know, throughout the series. Like I felt like it was being forced upon her, and I worried about her sense of agency in this process and the weight of the world on her shoulders, as in everybody's expecting me or her, you know, like everyone is expecting her to save the country or to move the country forward without, because Baek or the other lady were bad options, you know, whatever. Was the weight of the collective more heavier than her own personal desires? That's the one thing that I was concerned mostly at the end of this TV series, and I felt drawn to create this episode and to record this episode, because I do see the case of Mexico and in the case of Chile, when Evelyn Matthei and Michelle Bachelet also ran a presidential election in 2013, I also saw the weight of the collective pressure, not only from the people that wanted them to run, but also their political parties and the people that were backing them financially. In a way, it's good to have that quote-unquote support, if we want to look it at that way. But in another sense, if a person is not 100% sure that they want that political seat because they feel deeply inside that they can help the society. I wonder whether they may be fit for it at all. Whether they will enjoy it, or whether the seat itself will change them, probably for the worst. And it is a tricky statement because one of the things that I've been working not only on my research on women leaders and the courses that I've launched on this topic, particularly women leaders in Latin America, and the consulting that I've done with female political candidates and women that want to enter into politics, something that I've learned is that there is often a blindness to what winning an election, sitting on an office, holding that amount of power will entail. How will the seat change their lives? You see, there's this common perception that when you arrive into office, after you win your election, you are just gonna get the job done and you're gonna sit down and, you know, your new desk, and you're gonna start, you know, creating laws, or, you know, making executive orders, or start moving things around and changing and designating people. You know, like, you will just start going smoothly, you know, like you already have won, you know, like you should be on cloud nine. However, the reality is very different. You don't sit on an office and start, you know, giving orders right away. I mean, of course, it depends the country and the context and the culture. I know that there are many variants that could be, you know, at play here. But usually there is a period of adaptation and of understanding the bureaucracy and the extent of protocols that these decisions and the time that these decisions need to be made or wait for, etc. Like, it's not so simple as, the foreign affairs day, I'm gonna start moving things around and, you know, all peaches and creams and nothing. Like, no, from the first day, you will start getting a notion of how deep into the tiger's den you have entered, and you will start understanding the levels of protocols and the bureaucracy and why things before seem so easy to fix. Now, when you arrived, it's like, what is this? Like, I wanted to submit a new order or a new law or something, and now I see so much backlash and so much rejection and so much people that envy me and stab me in the back and, you know, wish me bad, and all these attacks from different fronts. It doesn't stop. And the interesting thing is we are often taught to rise into power, but not how to maintain power, political power, how to stay on that seat and do your job well, whatever it is that you want to do, your promises and your political values, etc. How to not lose yourself in the process when you sit down on that seat. How do you stop becoming the thing that you hated or criticized so much before? How can you remain free in a way? How can you remain and retain your agency? How can you do your job? How can you fulfill your promises? How can you help your population, your people, your society, whoever that you're representing, and those that didn't vote for you, you're also representing them. Mostly if you're like in a presidential position, you know, like you're not president for just the ones that voted for you, you're president of everybody in the country. So you need to also keep that in mind. How can you stay free? How can you look back at the term or the terms in plural that you served and say, thank you for this opportunity. I did what I could and I am leaving office as a better version of myself. There are not many cases of women leaders that have left their presidential or prime ministerial positions feeling and thinking, the two of them, feeling and thinking that they left their country's top position completely satisfied with, you know, the opportunity. You know, like when you're when you're doing volunteer job, or you know, like when you're like working in a specific big organization, you're like, oh, I'm just doing it for the experience. You know, like I don't care that they pay me very low, I don't care that they treat me like shit or whatever, I'm just doing it for experience. Okay, women that enter into politics that seek presidency position, the presidential position, or the prime ministerial position, they often don't do it because of the experience. You know, like they do it because they want to, you know, help their countries move forward, or they have a vision, or they want power, which is also valid. You know, people are different, they have different personalities. So anyway, I don't want to ramble too much. I just want to invite you to share your feedback, any other scenes and other ideas or questions that this TV series made you reflect upon. I know some of you shared on Instagram that you wanted me to review The Crown. So that's one of the series that probably will be creating a recording, but mainly focusing on the first two seasons, and I'll tell you why from the beginning. I've watched all the seasons except the last part of season 5, I think is the last one that is already. But one of the things that I noticed is that after season 2, the change of actress and also the change of a script, there's not much connection to the political side. Maybe the third season did, but the fourth and the fifth, they just focused a lot on, you know, the family struggles, etc. But I think that the first two seasons did showcase how difficult it was not only to become the Queen of England and the Queen of the Church of England, but also the head state of the United Kingdom and the head state of the Commonwealth. And I think that the first two seasons did exemplify that very clearly, and all the different scenarios where she had to take political decisions and develop her leadership. So I will be focusing mostly on those two, but it's probably in the following weeks that I'm gonna release that recording. I need to rewatch it probably to just refresh my mind. But thank you so much for sharing your feedback and your ideas. I would love to know your thoughts. Have you been following presidential elections this year or last year? Have you seen women in politics develop some sort of trends? Have you seen women voters as well having shifts depending on the different intersectionalities? Like, it would be cool to see and to speak with you and learn more about what's happening in your country or in the context or countries that you may be researching or focusing on. I'm gonna leave it here. I think I'm rambling too much. Thank you for tuning in, and talk to you soon.